Hello, Internet! Welcome to episode 171 of the Assorted Calibers podcast, the Second Amendment podcast that is a little bit for everyone. I'm Weird Beard, and with me, as always, is the most glorious hostess in the entire known universe. We've explored all the corners. That's what those people on the Dragon Capsule were up there looking for. They couldn't find a better host, so they came back to Earth to listen to Aaron Paulette. How you doing, Aaron?
I'm doing great. In fact, Spike, take a note. Dear Princess Celestia, today was a great day, and it's actually one of the best days I've had in a very, very long time. I didn't feel tired. I felt very productive. I didn't have a headache. Things went well. You know, assuming I can get through this podcast without Weird being a douche canoe, this will be one of the best days I've had in a long time. Your faithful student, Aaron Sparkle.
How often am I a douche canoe?
Sometimes, Weird. Sometimes you task me.
I mean, okay, guilty as charged.
From hell's heart, I spit at thee.
Well, I will not task you tonight, Aaron. We're going for the perfect score.
Alrighty then. How are you doing? I bet your day is not as good as mine.
Yeah, probably not. It's one of those. I've been super duper busy with just lots of stuff. My daughter's got back to school, and just the transition actually hasn't been that tough on her, but it's just been tough on me. I'm juggling a lot of plates, and there happens to be just a bunch of other stuff that was going on around. So I feel like I'm just hopping. And so I'm just like running around until it's time to go to bed. And then I go to bed, and then I awake when my mind decides that it has slept enough and it's time to start hopping. So it's one of those. There's a lot of like sitting bolt upright in bed going, okay, I guess I'm going to wake up now. And it's getting old, but I'm feeling a little bit better. The most of the fires are being put out, and it's actually, you know what? Normally Mondays kind of crappy. Not as good a day, but you know what? It went pretty smooth, so I'm not going to jinx it.
Well, okay then. Although, honestly, you describing your day of running, I just figured that's how your day went anyway, what with you being a stay-at-home dad and having the ADD.
I mean, it really is how my days go, but the difference is that am I running on my own terms, or am I, because I don't stop. Am I running on my own terms, or am I trying to keep up with the rest of the world? And it's been the latter this past week, and I've been barely scratching to hang on. And then the waking up with my heart in my throat is not a, I'm not a fan. No, thank you. I don't want to play this game anymore.
Well, you know, we don't have to play this game anymore. In fact, we should play the main topic game.
Yes. Yeah, we get a few.
We have three.
Yes.
Well, I mean, okay, I suppose a few could be two. I mean, if you say a couple is definitely two.
That's true.
And a handful could include three, but a handful could go up to five. Mm. So, all right, I'll let you have this one. It's a few.
And who says a handful is five? If I take a handful of M&Ms from a bowl, I mean, there might be as many as 20 in there.
Well, okay then.
But a handful,
I can't argue with that logic.
Includes the five fingers, so yes. And a couple is definitely two. And one is the loneliest number.
But Weird, a handful of breast is one.
Oh, that is true. But you have a pair of pants, but just one bra. Oh, the late, great George Carlin. But yeah, a handful of breast is just one. Sometimes they take two hands. I'm just saying.
We are never getting out of this.
No, we're just gonna switch gears on the
I don't know, this is like the conversational version of four-wheel drive, where it doesn't allow you to get out of places, you just get stuck in more exciting and inaccessible zones.
I remember hearing a friend of mine say that, like, he got his truck mired so bad that he literally left it in gear when he went to go get the truck just to keep the wheels spinning so it wouldn't sink any deeper. And, like, he was stuck so deep that, like, he just left it in gear and the car, it wouldn't stall and just the wheels are spinning, and he just jumped out and the wheels are spinning, and away he went to go get some, to go get a winch, hooked up the winch, and then pulled it out, and the wheels kept spinning, and they pulled the truck out once they got a hold.
But, I mean, have you ever seen a picture of a tank that's gotten stuck? Because that's impressive.
Oh, I've seen a few, and that's just one of those things of the, I feel that sinking pit in my stomach, because it's one of those, like, I've seen, like, I mean, I've been in some trucks that have been, like, sucked down, like, deep, like, I don't know how you're gonna get this one out. Like, I think one of them, like, somebody borrowed a bulldozer and used it, required a vehicle with treads to pull it out. But
the point being, a tank has treads.
Yes,
but if it's stuck, and, oh good god!
But in the end, it's one of those, like, it's your truck. The tank doesn't belong to you, and also, under no circumstances can you just break out your wallet and say, here, look, I'll write you a check for the tank. Sorry. No. It's one of those, like, oh, this is going on my permanent record, isn't it?
The military service is nothing but a permanent record.
This is one of those things that I'm going to have to explain for as long as I'm in the military. So, yeah, when my 4 years is up, I think I'm done. I was thinking about re-upping. I'm thinking that over now.
Or the corollary, I have to keep re-upping because of how much I owe.
Yes. Eventually I will do enough good and heroic things that maybe they'll forget about this time that I sunk a tank down to the turret.
I mean, I have literally seen a picture. I don't know of what tank, but like the driver's hatch, the little rim is just cresting the muddy water. And it's just, oh, that's bad. It's really bad.
Oh, you gotta wonder how tight they are. They're pretty tight. Because I remember actually asking a friend of mine on a modern, like an M1 Abrams, can you do the old Finnish Winter War trick of just cover it with Molotov cocktails, and it will either choke out the motor, choke out the soldiers, or heat the tank up hot enough that they have to open up the hatch, and then the Mosin-Nagants come in.
Well, I mean, that's probably true, but I do believe that modern fighting vehicles, which include both the Abrams and the Bradley, are sealed against NBC.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so, you know, in that regard, when they're buttoned down, I would imagine they are some degree of watertight. I mean, obviously, you get deep enough, you know, the atmosphere's pressure will force the water in, but just, you know, stuck in a deep pit in a small lake, it should be fine.
But yes, deep enough depth, even a submarine isn't waterproof anymore.
Exactly.
They call that a crush depth. And they call it that because that's exactly what it is.
Yeah, I was watching an episode of, I think it was Farscape, and their spaceship went down to the ocean floor, and it was like, you know, the ship was groaning and water was going everywhere. I was like, how is this possible? This ship is... It's a spaceship. It's airtight. And one of the smarter characters went, you idiot. It's designed to hold one atmosphere of pressure in, not hold out multiple atmospheres of water pressure from the outside.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's a big engineering difference.
Yeah. And actually, I guess I shouldn't have been, but I was still surprised on it. I mean, honestly speaking, the first time I saw it was in Down Periscope, where it was the
yeah,
old,
you're talking about the whole compression.
Yeah, it was the old craggy engineer that was, oh shoot, Brett from Alien. What is that actor's name?
I don't know.
Harry Dean Stanton. And I believe it was Roger Ebert who said that Harry Dean Stanton was never in a bad movie. And I think it checks out. Like every movie that I can think of that he was in, it's a good one. But yeah, Harry Dean Stanton played the old craggy engineer, And he tied a string across two pylons in the engine room while they were diving, and you'd watch
this. It was a taut string too.
Yeah, taut string, and then by the time they got down to the depth that they were at, their cruising depth, it had a belly in it because the hull was compressed. And they did the exact thing to Destin on Smarter Every Day. He got to go beneath the polar ice in a Los Angeles class. And they gave him a ton of access. Actually, a good friend of ours who is in the Navy, like, it got him all sorts of itchy because he's just like, how are they letting him do that? There's so much top secret stuff there. I mean, it's he essentially got there. He videotaped a bunch of stuff. They told him what he could and couldn't videotape. And then when it was all done, they're like, all right, cool. Now give me your memory cards and we'll give them back to you in a couple of days. And they went over every bit of the memory card, and you'll see there's little, you know, sensor blurs on there, and there are abrupt cuts in the tape because, yeah, somebody said something that was not fully cleared. But yeah, they did a deep dive while he was on board, and they tied a string up in the galley, and oh yeah, no, it started getting some belly. And of course, it's one of those, like, yeah, they're not going to make the sub completely incompressible. Like there's no magic that goes on with that. It's still going to get squished.
Yeah, but it's still kind of freaky when you realize, you know, this metal's the only thing that's keeping me alive, and it's squishing.
Mm-hmm. I mean,
this makes me nervous.
Yeah, but at the same time, it's one of those, like, yeah, it's still a really high-tech piece of well-maintained metal. I've been on a crappy fiberglass fishing boat out in the middle of the ocean in some god-awful storms, and I'm like, this might be the day.
Of course, the submarine they were on in Down Periscope was not, I mean, back in the day, it may have been tightly engineered, but it was a rust bucket.
It was a rust bucket, and it was a ragged up out rust bucket when they got a hold of it. For those that haven't seen Down Periscope, it is an absolutely incredible submarine comedy, and the gag is that Kelsey Grammer plays a captain that has had multiple disciplinary actions against him, and kind of as penance, he is going to play a war game where essentially a rudimentary faction might get a hold of an old diesel submarine, and they want to see if you can penetrate a modern seaport with old technology. And so and it's hilarity ensues because, of course, it's a very ragtag crew as well.
But yeah, it's a decent premise. You know, what if a third world nation got a hold of, you know, like 1960s, 1970s technology, and what could they do with it? And
yeah, and it's not like these various countries that have these mothballed subs are keeping really close track of them, or aren't above having someone write them a very, very handsome check, or in this case, briefcases filled with cash or conflict diamonds or whatever they've got, and just say, oh, yeah, must have sunk or something. I don't know. It was like that when I got here. Just reminded me of, speaking of me being out to sea of fishing boats, I was out to sea with a Czechoslovakian crew. And they were talking about, you know, the Iron Curtain Czech days, or they were Polish, excuse me. But they talked about, like, how the Russian mobsters would roll into their checkpoint, and they would trade guns for vodka. Just the, oh yeah, my duty weapon got lost, but I got a case of vodka, and evidently that was okay. Probably because the commander also got some vodka.
Mm-hmm.
Well, speaking of Russia, I guess I'll use that as a segue. It is time for some common sense gun control, Aaron. I say that facetiously, but and it's maybe I'm being in a little bad taste, but I have to point out, we often hear from the anti-gunners in this country, oh, you know, America, there's, you know, we're different in the world because we're the only country that has these mass shootings. And there was a mass shooting in Russia today at the time of our recording. We're recording this on the 20th. And this is the second one of this year on that. And of course, anybody that's paid any attention whatsoever knows that Russia has extremely tight gun control laws. And yet here we are looking at the second school shooting in the year 2021 in Russia. So one of the, I guess, interesting aspects of this one is that the shooter allegedly used a shotgun. Of course, note we are reporting on this the day of the shooting. By the time you hear this, you may learn that everything I'm about to say is completely wrong, because that is frequently the case with these stories. But multiple news sources are reporting that he used a shotgun that was designated for less than lethal munitions, or less lethal munitions. And somehow he had converted it to fire lethal ammunition.
Okay. Hold it. I understand less lethal ammunition in a shotgun. I'm not really clear on how you can make a shotgun less lethal.
I believe I was trying to look this up because I remember reading an article a while back, and maybe somebody who's listening could reach out and let me know exactly what part I'm missing. But I remember reading about certain police forces getting less lethal only shotguns. And of course, Aaron and I were talking a little bit before the show, is they absolutely make the shotguns with like the bright yellow or the bright orange furniture on them. And those are designated less lethal only, and just under no circumstances are you to allow buckshot or slugs anywhere near those shotguns. Mm-hmm. Those ones only get, you know, beanbags and pepper balls and rubber bullets and et cetera, et cetera. But I remember reading about there being a shotgun designed that could only take essentially specialty ammunition. I would assume maybe it has a slightly narrower profile so that a standard like 12 gauge wouldn't chamber in it, like a rebated rim or something like that. And that way, if you either a full-size shell would either sit too deep in the chamber and therefore the firing pin wouldn't reach it, or it wouldn't chamber in that gun, in which case it could either, by getting your hands on, say, a aftermarket shotgun barrel, or applying a little bit of modification to the shotgun, you could probably convert it back to taking standard 12 gauge rounds, or there's always the possibility of using reloading equipment to take these less lethal stuff and take out the less lethal business and put lethal business inside them.
Okay. Just from the way the article read, it sounded like, and I think there was one of them, maybe it was the NPR one, where they said it was a gun that was originally designed to fire plastic or rubber ammunition. And so it really sounded like he had an airsoft that he converted to shoot bullets. Mm-hmm. And, okay, while I acknowledge that is theoretically possible, it's one of those things where it's so much effort, you're actually better off just getting an illegal gun on the black market.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, it's like, but it's a shotgun. It's a large straight tube. How do you restrict the ammo? I was very confused. So thank you for explaining it to me.
Yeah. And of course, there's also a little in one of the articles that I've read said that he also owned a quote unquote hunting shotgun. I'm not exactly sure all the ins and outs of the Russian laws. I know specifically the easiest gun for a Russian to get is a smoothbore, and I tried to look it up. I forget what it's called, but there's actually a straight-walled cartridge that is based off of the 7.62 by 39 cartridge that has essentially that's been turned into essentially a shot shell. Or you can, it'll fire slugs as well, but essentially, but it's out of a smoothbore AK-47 style gun. Yeah.
So I'm not an expert on Russian firearms laws, but I've done a little bit of reading. And so Russian citizens 18 years or older can obtain a firearms license, but they have to first attend gun safety classes, and they have to pass a federal test and a background check. So they have to jump through all those hoops, and then they can only buy a shotgun. After 5 years of being good boys and girls with a shotgun, then you can purchase a rifle. Handguns in general are not allowed, although there is some growing popularity with shooting matches like IPSEC. And so you can own them, but they have to be stored at the club. So it's, yeah, the Russian laws are pretty restrictive.
Mm. And furthermore, another thing that you didn't mention in there, but also part of the approval process for the license, any of these licenses, is a mental health evaluation.
I did not know that at all.
Yeah, and that adds in. I don't know if it's as extent as, you know, you have to sit down with an actual therapist or go through stuff, mm-hmm. or if it's just something that needs to be signed off on by your physician, or the extent of that mental health evaluation. Mm-hmm. But I do know that section does exist, mm-hmm. which should add a little bit of a to all of this, in the fact that we know that if someone's going to be a school shooter, they've got to be a little bit crazy, because this guy killed, I think the report is saying, 8 people at this time. And then let's see, you know, at least another dozen people were further injured by the gunman directly. There's also a bunch of people that were injured probably from being trampled, and there's definitely mm-hmm. some people that jumped out of upper story windows just to get to safety.
Mm. But short version here, because you just kept on going, Russian firearm laws are way more restrictive than anything we have in the United States. Mm-hmm. And this still happened.
Yes.
But Brady and Bloomy and Demanding Moms all say, if we just had more laws, stronger laws, we could prevent this. Mm-hmm. Well, Russia has those stronger laws and more laws, and it still happened.
Correct. Yep, it still happens, and they still have large-scale massacres. And you know, we could argue on the frequency and population and all of that, but it's still a thing that happens. And of course, also, I decided to link this. I'm trying to remember when I talked about this, if it was back in the Gunblock Variety Cast days, or if it was in the early days of ACP, but I did a report on, this story. This happened back in, 2015. So that would definitely be Gunblock Variety Cast. And it was the largest ever UK seizure of weapons. And it was framed by the American press as, oh, this is the biggest weapons bust that has ever happened in the UK. And it's like not even remarkable in the United States. Except for they just talked about the number of guns. They didn't talk about the guns. And it turned out that the guns there were VZ-58 assault rifles. And when I say assault rifle, I mean assault rifle, as in these were all full auto guns. VZ-61 Scorpion machine pistols. And when I say machine pistol, these are not semi-autos. These are the little pistol-y things with the folding stock that will put you in prison here in the United States. And they've got the fun switch on them. Oh, and I want one so bad. Oh, they're so cool. But yeah.
They're cute too.
Yeah. And I believe, I'm trying to remember, see if they've got through. Yeah. And there were also grenades found in this cache. So the end story of this is that if you make something totally illegal, well, people are just going to seek out from alternative markets. It's not like you can make this stuff go away. And of course, I talked about how there were, you know, soldiers are perfectly willing to lose a full auto weapon for the right amount of for the right trade, and this happens in places all over the world, and you know, you just think about, hey, if we make guns as illegal as heroin, well, nobody'll ever use guns because nobody ever uses heroin, do they?
Marijuana is as illegal as anything can be made illegal, and teenagers can routinely score it while in high school.
I mean, I would argue that marijuana is a little bit different. I actually made a joke with Ryan Machad. Those that'll listen to the blooper reels will be hearing that one. We'll be hearing that one soon. But literally pointing out that marijuana is so easy to grow that even stoners can grow it.
I mean, that's true, but it doesn't contradict the fact that it is a Schedule One.
Oh yeah,
you know, it's right up there with crack and all the other bad things. Now, you know, we can argue that it doesn't deserve to be there, but it's there.
Supposedly, someone I went to high school with, he decided to plant some of his seeds in some pots in his room. And had some nice healthy little plants growing. They hadn't quite reached the point where they could be harvested just yet. And then his mom came into his room and saw the plants and realized what they were, and opened up his window and threw them out the window. And according to the story, she didn't go out to check to make sure that they were properly disposed of. And in fact, the plants plopped there down in the side yard. And then took root and continued to grow, and he smoked them. So yeah, it's much like Jurassic Park. Nature will find a way, and the data really pans out is that relaxing gun restrictions is the solution. I mean, again, look at the number of in the United States, the number of mass killings that happen in places where guns are banned. It and you can even see in when the killer leaves a manifesto or is questioned about it, if they're taken alive, you know, they are aware of people shooting back and they don't want that to happen. And so my argument is you can't make the guns go away. So instead, lift up, you know, and you can't keep the bad guys from getting guns. So make sure that the good guys have guns. Speaking of good guys with guns, Aaron, there's a new study out.
Really? Could it possibly be in regards to the massive amount of gun purchasing that's been going on for the past, 20 months at this point?
Yes. Yep. I've got a link to the Reload because Stephen Gutowski is awesome. And I just like before I start any show, I always go over to the Reload and take a look to see what the headlines are, just because the Reload is great at getting primary sources for things. And so, yeah, the National Shooting Sports Foundation did a firearm industry trade group survey. And they have reported in that survey that roughly 3.2 million people purchased a gun for the first time during the first half of 2021. That's amazing numbers.
So, yeah, weird. That's really good news. I mean, it's not really unexpected. It's just continuing a pattern. But out of curiosity, do we happen to know, like, the, you know, demographic breakdown? You know, is by perhaps race or sex?
Hold on, I clicked out. Does it say there?
Well, yes, it does, weird. In fact, it says more than 8 in 10 retailers report an increase among Hispanic American men and women as well. Likewise, over 76% of retailers reported increased sales among Asian American men and women.
Oh, that's awesome.
It is. Because first of all, I'm all for people arming themselves regardless of their race. If you are considered a minority and you think you're in danger, get one. If you're a minority and you don't think you're in danger and you want one, get one. But the other thing that I love is that it's not just one side of things. It's not just Hispanic men, Asian men, Black men. No, women are getting in on it too.
Mm-hmm.
And so, I mean, we know that women have been a hugely growing demographic in firearm ownership, and it's nice to see that this is continuing. as gun ownership spreads across the demographic smorgasbord that is America.
Yeah, it's great. And of course, also, I will again caution all of the people that may fit into the more quote unquote traditional demographic of firearms owners. What we would say, you know, the white conservative males out there. We also have to remember that these people are from potentially different walks of life. And I'm really thinking, again, we talked about David Chipman getting the boot, and it was Democrats that booted him. It could be simply along the more party line issue of race relations that got him booted, but also they really weren't that excited to get him on board from the get-go. And I think that's because a lot of them are knowing that the gun shops are just as empty in the blue states as they are in the red states. And there's a lot of people buying guns, and in places like California and Illinois and Massachusetts, where you need a permit to get these guns. These people are straight up identifying themselves and saying, "Hey, I'm getting myself my permit so I could go get myself a gun." And they're starting to see maybe going against the Second Amendment stuff might not be the wisest political move. So I just urge people to be cautious with stuff, saying stuff like owning the libs and talking about, you know, Democrats as if they are all anti-gun. I mean, there certainly is the issue, and Democrats deserve what they have wrought upon themselves. But I'm really hoping that we will start seeing that tide turn very, very soon.
So, speaking of the tide turning.
Oh, yes.
Or perhaps the worm has turned. Something has turned. And this is something I've been waiting for a while now, and it came from a completely unexpected source. Okay, so you've heard me rant about how bad the bump stock ban is, and how it's garbage, and you know that I hate Chevron deference, and we really need to take it down. Well, Ammoland has reported, and I've seen it other places as well, but Ammoland is the first place I saw it. And this is very interesting. A United States military court, I mean, literally a court-martial, the judges ruled that bump stocks are not machine guns. So what happened here? This is the United States Navy Marine Corps Court of Criminal Appeals. And this case is United States versus, and I'm going to butcher his name, Ali Alakazag, I believe. He's a Marine Corps private. And he was convicted of possessing two machine guns, in other words, bump stocks. Mm-hmm. And the defense counsel argued that bump stocks didn't meet the federal definition of machine guns. And a 3-judge panel agreed with the defense, unanimously ruling that bump stocks do not meet the definition of a machine gun. And, you know, the military, they would know.
Mm-hmm.
So, this is the first crack in defeating the bump stock ban, because now we've got legal precedent. And the one thing that the legal system clings to is precedent. When something is set, oh my God, it's so difficult to overturn. And so now we've got a military court. And actually, weird, I'm springing this on you. You may not know, but the military courts, I mean, are they their own circuit? Do they belong to a particular circuit or other? In other words, how would this go before SCOTUS?
I don't know. That is a very, very interesting, because, well, I don't think that they can they be challenged? Because
I don't know. I'm going to have to ask some of my lawyer friends.
Because also, but, the interesting angle on this is that, I mean, it's the government is the prosecution, and the government is the judge. I mean, in the case of,
well, the government's also the defense too.
Yeah, exactly. And so, I don't know if there's a court of appeals to the Uniform Code of Military Justice.
No, there clearly is, because right at the top of the article, it said the Navy Marine Corps Court of Criminal Appeals.
Okay.
So they've got an appeal system. I just don't know if there is a certain internal limit you can reach and that's it, or if it can then go before SCOTUS. I don't know. I was hoping you would know. I knew it was a long shot.
The military is interesting because also, part of, there's been lots of talk recently about, various military members speaking out against just the current political climate. I'll just leave it at that, because there's people on both sides of the political fence that are speaking out against how they feel about the military. And if they are doing it as active duty members, that could get them in trouble. And there's been a bunch of people that have had is terminated from the military, but they have
dishonorably discharged.
Yes. There are people that have been dishonorably discharged, and there's people who have affected their career negatively because of their political stances. And of course you point out, but we have a First Amendment right. We could talk about it. I mean, we just look at all the there's a whole bunch of people talking crap about Donald Trump, and then all of a sudden a whole bunch of people are talking crap about Joe Biden, and nobody's going to jail. But the military, you definitely surrender a whole bunch of your rights when you do put on the uniform. And so I don't know if they are as protected by the U.S. Constitution and make the appeal of court. You have absolutely put me on the spot, and I'm very, very interested in, and I hope a legal expert will chime in after they hear this episode and be like, oh yeah, no, this is how it works. I've always kind of seen the military as something a little bit kind of outside of civilian justice. And I see the Supreme Court as a civilian court.
But still, there is another court case that I believe is going before the Sixth Circuit Court of Appeals. I don't remember if it's a potion or if it's someone else, but there is another person who is challenging the bump stock ban. And this is going to be a massive arrow in their quiver.
Yeah.
Because, again, when they go to the appeal court and they can say, well, look, these three judges said not a machine gun, and they just got a major boost. And so hopefully, and I don't know, maybe this is going to sting me later, but right now I'm in a real positive mood. It's like, this is the first crack, and that's really all we needed, because once you can get that crack, then the force of of law and common sense, oh my God, I can't believe I'm saying that, it's going to bring this down. Yeah. Because, I mean, we lived through it. We know what happened. It went before Congress. Congress said, we're not touching this. The ATF said, look, by the rules Congress gives us, it's not a machine gun. And Trump said, I'm telling you to do it. And they went, okay. And that's not law. That's barely regulation. So yeah, hopefully this is the figurative shot heard around the world that'll take this down, and maybe please God, we'll take down Chevron deference too. Oh, I want that thing dead.
Yeah, I mean Chevron deference is horrible. The people who are enforcing the law should not also be writing the law, which is exactly what they're doing. But I'll also point out that there definitely appears to be a bit of a shotgun approach. Obviously, we've got the civilian courts are going after it. We've got this this case here, wherever this may go. But you're 100% correct. Whether this can make its way to the Supreme Court or not, it is legal precedent now. And the laws that they are citing are civilian laws. And the shotgun approach, furthermore, is that we also have rare breed triggers. We're told that their trigger pack, which is they call it a force reset trigger pack, where essentially as the bolt is coming home, it drives the trigger to reset, and so it creates a similar effect to a bump stock. I'd actually argue it might actually even feel a little bit better than a bump stock in how it fires. But the whole point is the trigger is absolutely being reset with every, every shot that is being fired on the gun, no matter how much it may look like full auto fire. And the ATF said, you are manufacturing machine guns, cease and desist. And they said, go pound sand. We're suing you for.
Oh, no. It's so much better. It's so much better. And if I had known you were going to go this way, I would have dug it up. But I read about this like a week or 2 weeks ago. And so whoever manufactures rare breed triggers, they figured the ATF were going to get all up in their butt. Mm-hmm. And so when they incorporated this particular, so they've got a specific division or whatever for making the triggers, and the company's headquarters is literally the lawyer's office.
Mm-hmm.
And this is a lawyer who knows guns, and when the ATF tried to come in and shut them down, I can't find the letter now. I'm going to have it in the show notes. It is a thing of beauty because the lawyer doesn't just say, hell no. It's a, no, you're going to screw yourself and I'm going to show you exactly how and why. And he explains, you're saying it's like this, huh? Well, first of all, you know, back it up. Secondly, I've got however many former ATF agents who have signed letters saying, no, it doesn't. And thirdly, you know, it's something like, I'm a lawyer and lawyer-client privilege, and you can just go piss right off. Mm-hmm. And I read that article, and I turned into that looping Jafe of the black kids with the, ah! It was just, oh, it was so, so beautiful. They may not have known it was coming, but they expected and they planned for it. And it's just so beautiful to see this perfectly executed strategy go forward. And just, ah.
Yeah. And again, the part of the team of, I'm trying to remember if he's the owner or what, or how the relationship actually ties together between this lawyer and Rare Breed, but essentially people who are more knowledgeable of such things than I am have looked at how this trigger pack works and are like, boy, that is a really, really clever design, both in how it functions, but also the specific legal terms of how it's functioning. And that's kind of the whole point of another thing that I haven't, that it's just, it's all popping into my mind as we're discussing this. I will put the Firearms Policy Coalition, before the bump stock ban went into place, they filmed Adam Kraut shooting an AR with a bump stock in it in high speed video, and with a close up of his trigger finger, and you can clearly see he is pulling the trigger every single time. The trigger is going to full reset. His finger is actually bouncing off of the face of the trigger and then goes back and fires it again and again. And it looks, at under high speed, it looks exactly like he's doing just deliberate rapid fire rather than bump firing the gun. And so because of that nature, it follows exactly what the letter of the law says. And so any one of these trigger packs that simulate full auto fire, I guess is the best way to lump them all together into one package, could potentially liberate all the others depending on how the court rules, because essentially this ATF ruling is, I mean, it's just straight up unconstitutional, and it's jive.
It's jive.
And Aaron?
Yes.
Speaking of jive, I done spoke some jive last week. We were talking about,
oh, Aaron. Did you now?
Yes. And Sean sent me a text message saying, weird, you got a whole bunch of stuff wrong about the North Carolina case that we were talking about last week, about the pistol purchase permits and censuring I think she was Congresswoman. Before I get anything more wrong, I said, you know what, Sean, why don't you record a segment and set me straight?
Since I live in North Carolina, and I'm involved in Grassroots North Carolina, the local civil rights lobby here, Weird and Aaron asked me to give you guys an update on how this whole pistol purchase permit drama is going. As you know, the anti-gun Democrat governor of North Carolina, Roy Cooper, vetoed House Bill 398, the repeal of the Jim Crow pistol purchase permit, which was overwhelmingly passed in the NC General Assembly. It passed 69-48 in the House and 27-20 in the Senate. While this is a very strong pass, it's less than the 3/5 which would be necessary to override. We would need 72 in the House and 30 in the Senate. Last week, Weird and Aaron told you how GRNC asked that one of the senators be disciplined for using false information to attack the Jim Crow permit repeal bill. At issue in this case is what the primary opponent in the Senate, Senator Natasha Marcus, testified during the Senate debate on the issue. In Mecklenburg County, in the last fiscal year, over 2,300 permit applications passed the NICS background check but failed the permit application. So if this bill passed, all 2,300 plus of those applicants will now have a new, unrestricted pass to purchase a handgun. When pressed privately for how she came up with this information, Senator Marcus eventually revealed that she was given these numbers by a lobbyist for Permitium, the contractor who maintains the computerized pistol purchase permit and concealed handgun permit application system used by something like 80 of the 100 counties in North Carolina. The lobbyist sent her this information by text messages, which the senator forwarded to GRNC. You will see that the text confirm exactly what I said on the floor. More than 2,300 permits were denied in Mecklenburg County after the last fiscal year due to issues that became apparent after the applicant had passed a NICS check. This proves that the permit check system is neither duplicative nor unnecessary. It is an important tool to keep handguns away from dangerous and unstable people, and it saves lives. Your efforts to eliminate it are reckless. Well, it's nice that instead of having to make the trek down to the sheriff's office to apply for a pistol purchase permit, you can apply online. We have to wonder how a lobbyist for a computer application contractor had access to the denial of permit data. Keep in mind that the application software doesn't make decisions. It just collects the data and forwards it to the appropriate sheriff for processing. Unfortunately for Senator Marcus and the lobbyist for Permitium, GRNC's Director of Legal Affairs, Ed Green, submitted a Freedom of Information request to the Sheriff of Mecklenburg County, asking for the total number of pistol purchase permit denials last year. Total denials for every reason were 2,378. Note, that's not 2,378 denied for some reason that wasn't caught by the standard FBI NICS check. That was the total number of denials for any reason for the entire fiscal year. The number of pistol purchase permit application denials quoted in your request appears to represent the total number of denials, or very close to the actual total, for the entire fiscal year, including denials based on NICS qualifiers. Mecklenburg County Sheriff's Office does not keep records distinguishing reasons for denial contained within NICS and reasons for denial outside of NICS, nor does MCSO keep easily accessible records that indicate all of the reasons for a pistol purchase permit application denial when there are multiple reasons for denying a single application. Then the nice permit clerk from Mecklenburg County provided a list of all the denial reasons. In typical government form, they have multiple categories that amount to the same thing, so I made a spreadsheet, combined the related categories, and totaled the numbers up. Out of 2,378 total denials, 1,705 were for reasons that NICS would catch. 593 were for paperwork reasons, including applicant failed to sign a release of court orders, lack of documentation we previously requested from you to process your application, applied in the wrong county, and failure to provide payment. Seriously, they denied 426 people their pistol purchase permit because they happened to apply in the wrong county, and one person because, for whatever reason, he forgot to give them their $5 mordita. And finally, we get to the last 80 people who were denied because sheriff not satisfied as to good moral character of the applicant. These are 80 people who have never been convicted of anything in any court, are not documentably drug users or criminals or mentally defective, but the sheriff just decided he couldn't trust them with their specifically enumerated constitutional rights. What we're not finding here is more than 2,300 permit applicants who passed NICS background check but failed the permit application. We're finding 1,705 who failed NICS, 593 who ran aground on dumb paperwork problems, and 80 who got screwed by the sheriff for no documentable reason. As you might imagine, GRNC President Paul Vallone got a wee bit miffed to find out that the primary Senate opponent of the pistol purchase permit repeal used wildly incorrect information to mislead the NC Senate with the clear intent of torpedoing this repeal of a Jim Crow gun law. Paul sent a letter to the Senate asking that she be disciplined for this. Not only that, the false information she used was fed to her by a lobbyist for the permit application system, a person who had no business even having this information, much less backdooring it to the senator. Keep in mind that the information on which these conclusions were drawn was not public data. When you fill out a government form, all of the personally identifying information on it is considered private. Any contractor who receives, uses, or processes that information is bound by the same information privacy rules that the government is bound by. Why exactly was Senator Marcus receiving this private data from a government contractor? We all know where this is going to go. Absolutely nowhere. As predictably as night follows day, the Republicans in the NC Senate will fail to discipline Senator Marcus for using demonstrably false information fed to her by a lobbyist for a contractor who has a clear financial interest in keeping this Jim Crow law in force. We all know that if the shoe was on the other foot, and a Republican used lies and false data to push a repeal of a Jim Crow law, the Dems would light him on fire and parade his body around the Capitol building. But spineless Republicans are spineless. The veto of House Bill 398 will likely be sustained. We'd need something like two Dem senators and two Dem representatives to vote against the governor of their party in order to override the veto. That's not really likely in a climate where Bloomberg money can make the difference between winning a primary election and getting buried in an avalanche of negative coverage and whisper campaigns. Our only hope is to beat them in the 2022 midterm elections. A pickup of three House districts and two Senate districts will restore the veto-proof majorities in both sides of the NC General Assembly. That's ultimately the only way we'll take control away from Jim Crow Roy Cooper and finally repeal the last of these terrible anti-gun laws that still remain in North Carolina.
Yeah, wow. I didn't know that she got the information from a lobbyist whose job was basically selling the pistol permit system. Wow, that's I mean, that's David Chipman level of conflict of interest. I mean, well, okay, he's a lobbyist, so it's not a conflict for him. But yeah, this guy is obviously not impartial. He absolutely has material gain here. Yet you've got to take everything he says with a dump truck full of rock salt.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, color me surprised. We got to protect our phony baloney jobs.
Harumph, harumph.
Harumph, harumph. And to hearken back again to what I said about the influx of new gun owners is for them to switch over and get it so that they can get this through in a veto-proof majority doesn't necessarily mean they have to switch everything over Republicans. I again will say that appears to be how it often goes, but there's nothing that is forcing Democrats to be anti-gun. There's really nothing in the standard Democrat platform on all their other views, you know, besides just the fact that, oh, we've loved gun control for a long, long time. And Bill Clinton was a Democrat and he was a super duper anti-gun president. Other than that nonsense, there's nothing stopping someone from taking an anti-gun Democrat that is up there and replacing them with a pro-gun Democrat.
Well, maybe the DNC.
Yeah. Yeah. There is always that. Yeah. I mean, and unfortunately, yeah, the case where I pointed out that Beto O'Rourke said, hell yeah, we're going to take your AR-15, and the entire crowd at the debate clapped and cheered, as well as every single Democrat candidate, and I think there was like 12 of them at that time, standing on that stage, was all clapping and smiled, and not a single one challenged Beto O'Rourke for what he said. So there certainly is, while Democrats are not anti-gun, and I'm not at all calling Democrats anti-gun, the DNC is, you're absolutely correct, Aaron, of an anti-gun organization at this time. All right, Aaron, I think that is just about enough politics for one show. Shall we get into some gun geekery?
Well, you've certainly come to the right place. David is here to tell us about not only cartridge cases, but also primers and how Boxer is different from Burden.
Hi, and welcome to Gun Lovers and Other Strangers. In this segment, I'd like to talk about the development of the metallic cartridge case and the hobby of cartridge collecting. The metallic cartridge case is the heart of all modern firearms. Repeating arms would be all but impossible to develop without them. But how did we get from loose powder and ball to the contemporary metallic cartridge we all know and love? The earliest cartridge cases were made entirely of paper and were discarded during loading and then later used for wadding and muzzle-loading firearms and consumed when fired. Linen and silk were also used to contain powder in early cartridges, but much more commonly for ammunition used in cannon. This basic system of cartridge design was used from around the 16th century right through the American Civil War. The first major step forward was the development of the percussion cap in the early 1800s, based on the priming pellet invented by Reverend Alexander Forsyth in Scotland and refined by Joshua Shaw into the familiar top hat musket cap that's still in use today on percussion firearms. Developing contemporarily with the percussion cap was the pinfire cartridge case developed in France by Casimir Lefacheaux, which became quite popular in Europe and was used in both handguns and long guns. Also in France around the same time, Louis-Nicolas Flaubert introduced the 22 caliber BB, or bulleted breech, and CB, or conical breech, rimfire cartridges. These evolved into the 22 short rimfire used by Smith & Wesson in their first metallic cartridge revolver. The pinfire cartridge held on for quite a while, but this system had some drawbacks. Primarily, the pin sticking out of the side of the case required loading the cartridges in a specific orientation so the pin was properly aligned, and even moderately rough handling could lead to them discharging in loose storage, such as a pocket. The rimfire design was obviously much more successful, and the 22 short expanded into a full family of 22s as well as larger chamberings. The famous Henry and Spencer repeating rifles used rimfire cartridges of various calibers, as did a variety of other firearms of the era. However, rimfire cartridges have their own shortcomings. One was the challenge of reloading rimfire cases. Another was the difficulty of finding a cartridge case material that was simultaneously strong enough to contain higher pressures while still being soft enough to detonate the priming compound when the rim was struck. Many of the earlier rimfire cases were made of copper, which was soft enough for reliable detonation. However, that same malleability limited the maximum power of these cartridges. Following the American Civil War, the concepts of the percussion cap and the rimfire case were combined into the centerfire, or central fire, cartridge case design. There were several different systems of centerfire priming attempted. The Berdan and Boxer primers are the most well-known today. In an interesting twist of fate, the Berdan system was invented in America by General Hiram Berdan and is still used in Europe, while the Boxer priming system, invented in England by Colonel Edward Boxer, is the main centerfire primer used in America as well as other countries. Here's a brief primer on primers. The main difference between these two priming systems has to do with what's called the anvil. This is the impact surface against which the cartridge pin pinches the priming compound. In the Berdan system, the cartridge case has the anvil built into the primer pocket and two offset flash holes for the jet of flame to pass through into the powder chamber. This makes for a simpler primer, but a more complex case that's also challenging to reload. In the Boxer system, the primer contains the anvil, and the case has a single central flash hole. Boxer primers are more complicated, and therefore more expensive to manufacture, but the cases are much simpler to manufacture and considerably easier to reload. All this history and variation leads us to the hobby of cartridge collecting. Since the field is so broad, most cartridge collectors specialize in some way, such as by rim type, rimmed, semi-rimmed, rimless, belted, or reduced rimmed, also called rebated, by priming type, pinfire, rimfire, centerfire, or inside primed, even by intended use, such as military, wildcat, target, or hunting, and there's an entire segment of this hobby dedicated solely to head stamps. The world of cartridge collecting is a fascinating look into the history of many fields in addition to firearm development, including chemistry, metallurgy, and ballistics. In this case, there really is something for everyone.
I'm Weird Beard.
The name sounds familiar, but...
I say that a lot of times.
That about wraps up this segment. If you have any questions for me or suggestions for future segments or a comment on a past segment, please post them on the Assorted Calibers Podcast Facebook or MeWe pages, and Aaron or Weird will make sure I get them. I'm also a contributor on the Blue Collar Prepping blog, which can be found at bluecollarprepping.blogspot.com. That's all for now. Thanks for listening. I'm David, and this is Gun Lovers and Other Strangers.
So, Aaron, I actually, one thing that I did this weekend was I got contacted by, or actually I've been talking to him for a while, ever since he's been going through the Massachusetts permit process, but he is a brandy new shooter. He had finally received his permit and wanted to come check out my gun club. And so we met up and it was great. I mean, it would have been even better if I had met him through Operation Blazing Sword. But
yeah, I was hoping that was the case, but I figured if it were, you would have led with it immediately.
Exactly. But we were out there, and amazingly enough, we had the range all to ourselves. And so, he was a brand new shooter. So he was getting that, like, his hands were starting to get a little shaky and all that. Cause like shooting muscles are muscles that don't get used for anything else. And I mean, I remember like, very first time I was shooting and I was just having a struggle to bring that 1911 slide back far enough to lock the slide open to clear the gun. And now it's just one of those, like, it just gets done. And so I was definitely spending a little bit of time talking to him in between strings just to talk and get to know the guy. And he's a super nice, interesting guy. But also to give him a little bit of chance to rest in between so that he's just not turning into Burger as we're going and we're getting sloppy shooting. And that's not fun for anybody. One of the guns he had was a Ruger GP100. And oh God, that thing was, I mean, they're not beautiful. They're very, very ugly revolvers. They are very utilitarian and very blocky and all that. But boy, I mean, it was really, really smooth and well put together. It's for something that looks as crude as it is. It was refined in all the right places.
It's the Glock of revolvers.
I mean, kinda. So he was talking about, you know, I pulled out a box of 38 specials for him, and he's just like, all right, so I realized, like, you haven't even shot this, have you? Like, I looked at it and the cylinder is like pristine. He goes, no, I haven't. And he's like, well, okay, well, now's the time. And he's like, all right, so these are 38s. So these are more powerful than 357 Magnum, right? Because 38's bigger than 35. And I went, oh. No, that's not how this works, but I can explain this to you, but stop me if it gets too geeky. And at no point in time did he stop. Like, he was just like, oh wow. With the talking about how back in the day when you had cap and ball revolvers, and then Roland White got his patent for boring through the cylinder so you could put a metallic cartridge in, they were stuck with a dilemma. They could no longer have a bore-sized cartridge being put into that chamber and still have room for a metallic cartridge. So the question was, do you shrink the barrel down and also shrink the projectile, or do you shrink the barrel down and keep the same projectile size, or do you shrink down the projectile and keep the barrel the same size? And so it was one of those. So suddenly the 38 caliber black powder revolver turns into a 35 caliber ball being shot from a cartridge. And so don't ever be fooled also by the name of your cartridge, because they're almost always lies. I know David shares my love for European designation of cartridges, so that, you know, you've got your, you know, 11.43 by 23 millimeter. Oh. And I do like it because it tends to be a little bit more honest than 44 Magnum, where it's a 42 caliber bullet. It's not even 44 or something like, you know, 460 Smith & Wesson Magnum, where it's just a 454 caliber bullet. Why are you calling it a 460? We're calling it 460 because it's different. Well, good.
I just want to make it clear that I'm not laughing at your friend. I am laughing because I have had these same conversations. Mm-hmm. I have asked these same questions, and it's like, yep, everyone goes through it.
Yep, yeah, it does. It is absolutely. But yeah, even then, you still get weird cartridge names like the whole. I'm trying to remember if it started with, now I'm going down a super geeky road. And Aaron,
I mean, I remember, and it wasn't that long ago when I had a really no crap moment when I learned that 45 Long Colt and 45 Colt, aka 45 ACP, were two completely different types of bullet.
Mm-hmm.
And it was just, wait, no, what? But they're both 45. How can this be? So yeah, I'm still learning things.
I think it's 30 Borchardt, 30 Mauser, and 7.62 Tokarev are all externally exactly the same cartridge. They're all loaded to slightly different powder charges and pressure levels, and they all have completely different European designations.
I just want to back you up. Borchardt?
Yeah. Yeah, that was the first gun that was based off of the Luger.
So if you shoot one, you Borcharted?
I mean, yes.
You sharted right in your bore. I'll be here all week, folks.
Yeah.
Tip your waitress.
I just posted a picture of it in chat so you could look at how painfully ugly that gun is.
You know, it's still not as ugly as a Dardic.
No, it is not. No, the Dardic was really, really, really ugly.
It honestly looks like someone tried to race gun a Luger.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. I mean, it's the predecessor to the Luger, but yeah, it's got that big toggle lock hanging off the back. Yes. So yeah, and the Borchardt cartridge was 7.65 by 25 Borchardt. The Mauser cartridge is 7.63 by 25, and the Tokarev is 7.62. They're all 308 bullets. So yeah, the even the European designations sometimes lie just to be different.
It's marketing.
Thanks to each and every one of our listeners, and a very special thanks to all our supporters on Patreon. To become a Patreon patron, go to patreon.com/AssortedCalibersPodcast to sign up. Patrons get an early release of the podcast, plus they get bonus content. Ooh, bonus content. It's extra stuff. Like, you get the blooper reels. You get to hear off-topic discussions and terrible jokes, and it's hilarious. You get to hear Xander have Dr. Pepper come out his nose. Like, I just listened to that like 5 times before the show started. You'll hear it soon. And we also have the ACP film tracks, where you can watch movies with us, and the ACP mag dump.
Also, please remember to rate us on Apple Podcasts, subscribe to us on the platform of your choice, and share the show with your friends, both online and off.
You can get more from me at my blog, which is weirdworld.com. That's weerdworld.com. And you can also hear me weekly on Handgun Radio, which is on the Firearms Radio Network.
Ooh, you got it all sexy.
Yeah, I'm having fun.
You can get more from me at my sexy, sexy nerd blog, Lurking Rhythmically. And preparedness is also very sexy. And so you can find my preparedness blog, Blue Collar Prepping. And of course, my firearms advocacy, Operation Blazing Sword and Pink Pistols. Both of them .org. Because we all know how important that org is. Isn't it weird?
I always think that with org. And thanks to Nate Spencer for our music. And Nate has worn a lot of hats. He's been a professional musician. He's done all sorts of careers. He was a waiter once, and someone filled out a waiter survey card, and they said we love Nate because he has bedroom eyes. He kept that one.
He sharts in his boar and I don't. Our cleanliness is assorted, and so is our podcast. Good night, everybody.
Good night.